is Red Eyes Radio.
Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, your host, and I'm coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Thank you all for tuning in, and you're in for a real treat today because we have Andrew Collins with us on the line today, and this is going to be a very interesting program. And I think most of you out there who regularly visit my site, red-eyes.net, are familiar with the name Andrew Collins. He has written quite a few books, and just let me briefly read the titles for you so you know where we're at here. 21st Century Grail, Gateway to Atlantis, Gods of Eden, Tutankhamun, The Exodus Conspiracy, Alien Energy, and From the Ashes of Angels. And we're going to begin today to talk about Andrew's latest book, The Cygnus Mystery, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correct, by the way, but we recently contacted Andrew, and we found out that he's got a new book coming out here, so this is excellent timing, and I've been briefly reading about his book on Andrew's website, which you can check out at andrewcollins.com. That's Andrew, C-O-L-L-I-N-S.com, andrewcollins.com. And I'm going to let Andrew talk more about his book and let him share with us what he wants about his research and his main thesis behind this book. And it's a fascinating subject, and I can't wait to dive right into this. So welcome to the program, Andrew, and thank you very much for being here.
Hi, it's great to be with you here.
Excellent.
Well, okay, let's start with this new book then. People will say, well, what is Cygnus? I mean, Cygnus is a very familiar star group in the northern sky, and it has the appearance of a great cross. And in fact, it has been connected with the Calvary cross of Christ since at least the 6th century AD, and possibly even earlier. So it's a very, very familiar sight in the night sky, and it is visible at the moment during the mid to late evening, directly above you. But Cygnus itself has been a constellation which has been underrated, I think, in the past. I mean, we know, obviously, about more familiar stars like Sirius, or constellations like Orion, or maybe even Ursa Major, you know, the Big Dipper or Great Bear. But Cygnus is a very, very important star group. It is the oldest represented constellation anywhere in the world. It is found within the famous cave of Lascaux in the Dordogne region of southern France, where it was painted by Paleolithic artists as early as 17,000 years ago. Plus, in southeast Turkey, the very oldest stone temples anywhere in the world, which date to 11,500 years ago, these are aligned to Cygnus. And this is the same story all around the world, from the pyramids of Egypt to Avebury, the largest stone circle in Europe, and the rock and mound effigies of birds in the Mississippi-Ohio valleys, through to the Incan peoples of Cuzco in Peru, to the Maya and the Olmecs of Mexico. All of them revered Cygnus as a very, very important cosmological symbol to do with cosmic life and death. The belief that the soul came from the heavens, came from the direction of Cygnus, and would one day, upon death, return there. It is also part of shamanic beliefs right the way across Asia into North America, and is found amongst various Native American Indian tribes. So, you know, you must say to yourself, right from the word go, why was this constellation so important to our ancestors?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, is this something that you did you pick this up from elsewhere? Because I've actually never heard of it before. Okay, I haven't been doing the research that you have been doing, but this is actually the first time I've heard it being aligned to megalithic sites and so forth.
Well, okay, the way that I came into this story was that I wrote a book called From the Ashes of Angels, which talked about the very earliest priestly elite, the shamans, who were in control of the so-called Neolithic revolution or Neolithic explosion in the Near East, maybe 11,000, 12,000 years ago, that these people were very lightly remembered in Judaic and Christian ancient texts as the so-called Watchers and Nephilim of the Book of Enoch.
Yeah.
And because of this, you know, I researched and wrote heavily about this area of the globe and was finally able to visit there in 2004. And I witnessed here the oldest stone temples anywhere in the world. And these have the most incredible, beautiful carvings of animals and birds, most particularly the vulture, which was a symbol of mortality and of the soul and of life after death. And what was most fascinating is the fact that these ancient stone temples like Göbekli Tepe, Karahan Tepe, Kainu, and Nivali Kori, although the later one has been destroyed by waters that filled a dam recently, is that they were all orientated roughly towards the north. And what's so interesting is that this interest in the north was preserved in the same region by the peoples that followed the earliest Neolithic cultures and races of the area. And these became known in classical times as the Sabians. And the Sabians, who were like the indigenous peoples of this area, also revered the north and also the North Star as the place of cosmic life and death. But of course, the thing is that the North Star that we know, the pole star around which the whole of the northern heavens turns, is Polaris. But this has only been present as the pole star for the last 2,000 odd years. Before this time, there were earlier pole stars. And if the beliefs of the Sabians did go back to the very earliest Neolithic peoples of this region, then quite clearly, these earlier peoples were looking at a pole star in the sky, which was different to Polaris because of the process of precession that gradually changes the backdrop of the stars as we view them from Earth over a period of something like 26,000 years. But if you go back to 11,500 years ago, what's so interesting is that there is not a pole star at all. That there was just a dark hole where the stars revolved around. Indeed, you have to go back to about 11,000 BC to find that the previous pole star, you know, that made any sense. And this was Vega, in the constellation of Lyra. And this was a position that it had held for 2,000 years since 13,000 BC. So what I did was I checked with astronomical calculations to see whether Vega was being sighted by these early megalithic temples. And it wasn't at all. It didn't fit whatsoever. So I thought, well, you know, what is it? And I looked at the skies and very carefully calculated the orientation, the alignments towards the north from these early megalithic temples. And they were focused on one particular star, and this was Deneb, which is the brightest star in Cygnus, which in classical times became known as the celestial swan. And but having said that, in these early megalithic temples, they seem to have been interested in this star and the star group around it. But what is interesting is that they would seem to have associated it, from what I can see from later research to do with, you know, the region and their interest in the northern sky, with the vulture, which was indeed their symbol of cosmic life and death. So they saw this as a personification of the celestial vulture in the sky, because clearly, you know, swans were not of the same importance as they were in other parts of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Their soul bird, their psychopomp, as the term is used in Greek classical tradition, you know, the soul carrier, was the vulture. This was represented in the sky originally as Cygnus. But what's so interesting is that Deneb and other stars from Cygnus had originally been the pole star from around 16,000 BC through to 13,000 BC. But for 3,000 years, they had been acted as the pole star. And what I was beginning to realize is that for some reason, the megalithic people who created these first temples, you know, the watchers of the Book of Enoch, were interested in a star which had been a pole star several thousand years before their time. It's as if they were preserving the memory of a much earlier tradition that went back to Paleolithic times, to the very era that the cave artists were drawing, you know, Cygnus in the form of a bird on the end of a long pole within the Lascaux cave in southern France.
Yeah.
So this was beginning to make sense. Plus, we know that in shamanic tradition, there is the tradition of the cosmic axis that is said to be the turning point of the heavens that is joined to Earth, to a spot, a location known as the Axis Mundi, or the, you know, the axis of the Earth, the turning point of the Earth, by what's known as the sky pole.
Yeah.
Now, this sky pole, although a symbolic form, actually corresponds with what is known as the meridian line, the north-south meridian line. So that if you look up towards the northern heavens, if you can imagine from the exact point of true north, a line that rises up to the pole star, this was seen as the sky pole.
Yeah.
But the sky pole was also, in a secondary manner, connected with the rising and appearance of the Milky Way. And this is the other important element here, because Cygnus is positioned at the very extreme northern part of the Milky Way, where the Milky Way breaks into two and forms like this dark rift, which is actually known as the Great Rift. It's an area of dark stellar debris, you know, gaseous matter and dust and whatever that you can visibly see in the sky, and splits the Milky Way in two. And exactly where it splits is where the stars of Cygnus, the cross-like formation of stars, which is known as the Northern Cross as well, I should have pointed that out, is actually positioned. And what we must remember, that in traditions all the way around the world, whether they be shamanic or religious, the Milky Way was seen as a road or river to the stars.
Yeah.
So we've now got two different paths to get to Cygnus, one via the Milky Way, and the other one via the so-called north-south meridian line.
Yeah.
And both of them would take you to the exact same position. And once you start understanding this, and you understand that this this cosmological idea of the sky goes back to at least 15,000 BC, maybe 16,000, you can see that we're dealing with a very, very old belief.
Yeah, indeed.
That is associated with rituals and that is found worldwide. Because after I started to realize that this was so important to the Near East, and quite obviously to Europe and Asia, I looked towards the Americas for confirmation.
Yeah.
Because as we know, according to conventional archaeology and science, there was a land bridge that linked Asia to America through until the end of the last ice age,
yeah.
allowing peoples to migrate across the so-called Bering Strait down into North America. And then it was cut off. And in theory, although quite clearly we all know this is not quite the case, in theory, the peoples of America were left in isolation through until, you know, the time of discovery, you know, conventionally, the Vikings, although we know that there's good evidence for peoples reaching there thousands of years earlier.
Exactly.
But what I felt was that if I could look towards North American tradition and find that Cygnus was also important there, then there was a very good chance that I was right in my belief that it was of Paleolithic origin.
Yeah.
And in that, exactly what I found. I found that a number of Native American tribes revered Cygnus as the place of origin of the soul where it would return in death. They referred to Cygnus as the bird foot or the turkey foot, which was a representation like a three-pronged fork, which can be formed by its stars. Indeed, this is interesting because this same representation of a bird foot is universally associated with Cygnus in various parts of the Near East and in Asia as well. But beyond this, I found that I looked at a number of the very oldest mound sites of North America and found that many of them were actually orientated towards the Milky Way at the time of the summer solstice.
Yeah.
The summer solstice sunrise would occur, but 2 hours beforehand, the Milky Way would be seen at exactly the same position where the sun would rise, and you would see it rising vertically up into the air, directly above to where Cygnus would sit.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think what's important here, and you know, some of your listeners might be saying, well, you know, why would these people be taking so much interest in a star group?
Yeah.
And the answer to this is very plain and simple. Today, you know, we can walk out of our houses, we can look up and we can see a few stars. You know, we can probably see, you know, 100 or so, maybe more.
Yeah.
But there are actually thousands of stars that are visible in the sky. And all you need to do is to go out into, you know, the countryside, and you'll begin to perceive how important the starry sky would have been to these people in the past.
Indeed.
So if you then realize that in the past there was no pollution, there were no lights, you know, there was nothing that would obscure the view of the stars at night.
Yeah.
And they take on paramount importance to religious traditions, religious beliefs, religious rituals.
Yeah, indeed.
And it, in a manner which I don't believe we fully comprehend at this time. I mean, people like Robert Bouval has done a lot to show the significance of the Orion constellation in places like Egypt.
Yeah.
And this has been very important to establish just, you know, how strong our ancestors brought, you know, stars and star systems into their beliefs. The Maya also saw stars and star groups as very important, and we know this.
Yeah.
However, this was a universal thing. It was not just in Egypt. It was not just in Mexico. It was all over the world.
Yeah.
And even though today the brightest star in Cygnus, Deneb, is only the 18th brightest star in the sky, the constellation as a whole and its position on the Milky Way was of crucial importance to, you know, the ideas of the survival of the soul and of the origins of life in the cosmos.
Yeah.
Now, this is jargon or whatever. I mean, work done by Michael Ruppengluck, a professor at Munich University, has basically said everything that I'm now telling you. You know, he was the guy that established that Cygnus is actually represented as the oldest constellation in the world within the Lascaux Cave. This announcement was made in the year 2000. And I've been in touch with him, and, you know, he's now very familiar with my independent work that, that I've done. However, what you've got to say to yourself is, you know, was it simply its astronomical importance that allowed Cygnus to remain so strong in the mindsets of people? And this is where we start getting into very interesting areas, because obviously when it first began to be worshipped, venerated, or seen as important was in, during Paleolithic times. The very exact moment that people began to go into deep caves and perform religious ceremonies, generally in altered states of consciousness, most probably drug-induced, or certainly using some kind of trance state. At such times, these people believed that they were in communication with supernatural intelligences, and that they could achieve otherworldly wisdom and knowledge. And this is the very time that they start depicting Cygnus on the walls for the first time. And I wondered what it was that made them think this, and why they should want to depict Cygnus deep in caves. And not just on the entrances, right in the deepest parts. And this is not just at Lascaux in southern France. Michael Ruppengluck, the professor at Munich, is working with more researchers who are looking into other caves and finding Cygnus. And I've looked into the only caves in Britain that have rock art, and have found that in their deepest part are representations of birds, including the swan, and that I found that they are also aligned to the position on the horizon, on the meridian of Cygnus. You know, so the tradition is here, and was here in Britain, you know, during a similar period of time.
Now,
so, you know, there's something going on, and what is it? So I looked into caves, I looked into Cygnus, I looked into, you know, astronomy, astrophysics, just to see if there was anything that made sense. And then I struck on something which I simply could not ignore. And this was the fact that during the early 1980s, various underground particle detection facilities around the world, in Europe and in the USA, suddenly began to register the disintegration of incoming particles, cosmic rays, which they had not expected. Now, what's important about these facilities is that they are sited generally in mines or beneath mountains, beneath, you know, sort of many hundreds of meters of rock. And the reason why they are placed down there is to stop cosmic rays from affecting any of these experiments. So to find that there were cosmic rays reaching these depths was a mystery in itself. But what was more interesting is that they were giving off a kind of signature or fingerprint. And this fingerprint was easily detectable as having come from a binary system in the constellation of Cygnus, known as Cygnus X3. Which is actually around 30,000 light years away from here, which sounds a long way away, but it's actually inside our galaxy. And what Cygnus X3 is either a black hole a neutron star, they're not sure which, which is orbiting around another star, which it's drawing all of its power from, all of its energy.
Yeah.
And this is creating a huge disk of plasma energy, which is producing these incredible beams of stellar debris that are shot out tens, if not hundreds, of light years, you know, into the galaxy.
And Andrew, are these the same as gamma ray bursts?
Gamma ray bursts are a part of this, but gamma rays are a lower energy level than cosmic rays themselves.
Okay.
Cosmic rays are the highest known energies anywhere in the universe. And astrophysicists still do not understand much about them, other than to be able to determine their energy, whether they have mass and their velocity. But as for their direction, it depends whether they are charged particles, which means that they are scrambled by the galaxy's gravitational field and that of our own solar system as well, and our own Earth as well. The gravitational forces will, and the magnetic fields will basically send them going all over the place, and you won't be able to tell where they come from. But if they have, if they are neutral particles, they bypass all of this and are not affected by any fields at all.
And they
will hit the Earth, and, well, so I want to say hit the Earth, and generally they will hit the atmosphere and be destroyed, creating secondary particles, which will then rain like showers down onto the Earth. But just occasionally, cosmic rays can be so powerful that they will penetrate deep into the ground. This is very, very infrequent. But what was happening in the 1980s is that this was occurring regularly, and that the fingerprint quite clearly showed. When I say fingerprint, what I mean by this is that they had a so-called periodicity, a cycle of exactly 4.8 hours. And 4.8 hours was the exact orbit of the two binary objects in Cygnus X-ray going around and around each other. This was known from the detection of other types of particles, like X-rays, like radio emissions, and gamma rays themselves, and infrared. So it was known that this was a cycle, and no other stellar object has this same cycle. Plus, the cosmic rays were rising and falling in accordance with the appearance of Cygnus in the sky. In other words, they were at their most strongest when Cygnus X-ray was overhead, and when it was set, they would stop. Now, this also showed that they were not, these particles were not neutrinos. Neutrinos are emitted by, you know, stellar objects, in mostly supernova, you know, exploding stars, but also the sun itself. But these pass through the Earth and pass through us all the time without interacting with anything. And, you know, that their direction is very difficult to calculate. But with the particles coming from Cygnus X-ray, they were totally unique. They were penetrating, because they were so strong, their energy was so strong, penetrating hundreds of meters of rock. And these facilities, you know, which generally consisted of, you know, huge chambers of pure water. And the particles go through them. And what happens is that as they disintegrate, they give out a type of radiation known as Cherenkov radiation. And this is almost like a little light burst. And this can be registered by, you know, very sensitive photo equipment, and this can register the presence, you know, within these chambers of the presence of the cosmic rays, and this is exactly what was happening. And so that was that. Now, what's interesting is that there was a great number of articles written about these particles from Cygnus X-3, which even gained their own name. They were known as Cygnets. Cygnets, mm-hmm. obviously being the name of, you know, baby swans.
Yeah.
You know, after the fact that they were coming from, you know, the direction of the swan, the cosmic swan, the celestial swan, Cygnets.
Yeah.
And because they were just so strange, so weird, other facilities that were not registering them for whatever reason, the type of rock, the distance from, you know, the surface or whatever, started to criticize the reports of the other facilities, and there became a huge controversy surrounding them. And the matter was dropped. And by the end of the 1980s, nobody really wanted to know about the subject anymore because it was just too controversial. And this is despite the fact that at least one of these facilities has continued to register these incoming particles, cosmic particles, right the way through to at least 2001. So they're not some, you know, phantom, you know, that doesn't exist.
No, they're
but also, you know, they have been registered by other types of facilities at ground level as well, that are monitoring things like gamma ray bursts and things like this. So these are not, you know, ghosts in the machine, as it were. But the significance of reading this and understanding this made me look at whether these particles may have been entering the caves deep underground maybe 17,000 years ago. And I then established that Cygnus X-3 has been in its current phase for over 700,000 years. So, you know, periodically the Earth would have been bombarded with these extremely high-energy particles all the way through the evolvement of the human species, you know, we can take to be over the last 500,000 years, at least. And so I wondered whether the Paleolithic shamans deep down in the caves somehow became aware of the presence of this cosmic rays. Now, people might say, how would this be possible? Well, actually, it would be very, very easy because of this type of light bursts known as Cherenkov radiation.
Yeah.
Now, let me give you a little bit of history about Cherenkov radiation.
Yeah.
The Apollo 11 space flight to the moon, when the astronauts got into space and they tried to sleep, they found that as they were falling off to sleep, going obviously into a light relaxed state in readiness to fall into deep sleep, they suddenly saw light bursts in their eyes.
Yeah.
Now, this occurred when they were both had their eyes open and their eyes closed. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
Which meant that something was actually going on, not objectively in front of them, but actually in their eyes.
Yeah.
And of course, when we say in the eyes, in the water of the eyes, just like in the underground facilities. And NASA immediately launched an investigation, a research project, with later Apollo missions, and determined quite satisfactorily that these were incoming cosmic rays that were causing this through this process of the disintegration producing this type of radiation within water that produces light bursts. Which come in the form of little flashes, that's what they are.
And
they are generally only seen in total darkness.
Fascinating.
Now, the thing is that under normal circumstances, we will not be able to see Cherenkov radiation because we are not in the right state of mind. There is too much light interference. You know, even in a darkened room, there are, you know, lights probably outside of our house. You know, there is the glow from the local town.
Yeah.
You know, we do not see them. We do not expect to see them.
Yeah.
However, if you put yourself into total darkness with your eyes either open or closed, it doesn't matter, although it's probably more fun when your eyes are open, you will start to see little flashes and bursts of light. Now, these will come probably about once every couple of minutes, 3 minutes, and they would generally be a light blue. Some of them are white, some of them may be other colours as well. Now, this is natural. This is something which occurs all the time. You know, your listeners can try it for themselves. It's very easy to do. And it's an objective experience in the sense that, you know, cosmic rays really are passing through their eyes and, you know, because they're so short-lived, really, they are disintegrating as they pass through the eyes and you see them. Now, if you think of now going down deep into a cave, hundreds of metres underground, you don't see cosmic rays down there, in theory. The only ones that you will regularly see are those from Cygnus X-3.
Ah, okay.
And the thing is that it will be cyclic, it will be periodic.
Yeah.
Because they once the Cygnus sets, that you no longer see them. But once it's high in the sky, they will be visible. And then when it's, you know, it sets, you know, you see where I'm getting. In other words, it would be quite easy over maybe, you know, years, maybe tens of years, maybe hundreds of years, for people to have eventually realised there was a connection between these bursts of light, which they would probably have experienced in a altered state of consciousness, and the presence in the sky of the Cygnus constellation.
Yeah, so they were able to pinpoint.
So they were able to connect Cygnus with these light bursts, connect them with what they would see in terms of maybe a religious experience, or the presence of some kind of supernatural form. But that's on one level. That's on an immediate level. On a much more long-term level, we come to this, and this is that during Paleolithic times, ice cores extracted from Arctic and the Antarctic have shown that there were periods of intense cosmic ray activity. Now, for our purposes, the last period of intense activity probably began around 15,000 BC, i.e. around 17,000 years ago. There was another much earlier period around 40,000 to around 35,000 BC. And there may have been earlier periods than this, but let's look at these two later periods for the moment. Between 40,000 and 35,000 years ago was exactly when Homo sapiens underwent their greatest ever change. They began painting the most incredible art in caves all over Western Europe. Now, this is the oldest cave art that we know of anywhere in the world. You know, maybe 10,000 years later, it has appeared in parts of Africa and in parts of Australia, but the oldest rock art that is so far known is found in southern France. In fact, it's the Chauvet Cave, which has incredible images of everything from horses to bisons to rhinos to the female form accentuated through the rock itself. And also at this very same time, you know, there were great advances in the use of personal items, of symbolic art, you know, beads and things like this. It's not to say that we hadn't dabbled with, you know, symbolic art before this time, because, you know, the oldest representation of art probably goes back to something like 80,000 years ago in South Africa. There is a piece of red ochre rock that has incised lines on it, like crisscrossing. This is seen as the earliest example of symbolic art. But this is nothing really compared with what suddenly took place, you know, around 40 to 35,000 years ago. At this time also, we find that there's the first reverence of the dead, you know, being placed in graves with ornate rituals being performed over them. in the personal items that are being left with them, it's quite clear that there is a new transition here to the idea that the dead are meaningful and that there is a good reason to bury them, because maybe, just maybe, people started to believe at this time that there was an afterlife. And other changes in symbolic thought seem to suggest that there was cohesion in religion for the first time. But this is something that, although begins around 35,000, 40,000 years ago, does not really take full effect until around 17,000 years ago, when sickness first starts appearing in the walls of Lascaux in southern France. Because here, again, is another sudden acceleration. Now the caves are again being used, but this time even deeper than they were before. The most sacred art starts to appear, you know, in the deepest parts of the caves. It is never, vandalized. It is always taken as sacred. It's quite clear that here is where the most sacred ceremonies, the most sacred rituals, shamanic experiences took place.
Yeah.
Not in the mouths of the caves, which were often either used for communal purposes, you know, or would be avoided because obviously here you would find wild animals and things like this.
No,
you know, some of this art now starts appearing, you know, maybe kilometers underground. And there is no reason for this. Some of the top Paleolithic, you know, art researchers into rock and cave art have said, why should this be? And this process continues on right the way through to about 11,000 years ago. And then we have the Neolithic Revolution in the Near East. Right, not the same area, but time-wise, something big has gone on. Something has led to the rise of civilization now. The first stone temples in the Near East, which, as we said, aligned to Cygnus. And something major is taking place now. The transition, obviously, also coinciding with the end of the last ice age, you know, the gradual warming of the climate, all the rest of it.
All this is
a part of it. But why did civilization suddenly begin at this time? And what I'm suggesting and what I'm proposing in the Cygnus Mystery, of which you can find all of this information in, or most of it at least, is that there is a strong possibility that cosmic rays could have accelerated human evolution at certain periods, probably around 35 to 40,000 years ago, and then later around 17,000 years ago.
Fascinating. And you, a passage here that you sent me in a mail, I can just read it briefly. It says, ever since the discovery in the 1920s that radiation causes mutation in DNA, the heredity material of life itself, scientists have wondered what role high-energy cosmic rays might have played in evolution. Now, a new book by science and history writer Andrew Collins provides stunning evidence that cosmic rays not only change evolution, but were responsible also for the acceleration of both civilization and, amazingly, even organized religion. So you are incorporating all of these ideas of kind of evolutionary bursts, I guess, and the spawning of new religion and so forth to this constellation and to this star, then, I guess.
I am.
Yeah.
And a couple of points here. Firstly, I'm not saying this is the only influence that came to bear upon human evolution. There probably, in the southern hemisphere, may have been different stars that played similar roles. I'm not discounting that at all. You know, maybe Orion, maybe Sirius, I don't know. This is one solution. But secondly, what's important here is that the idea that cosmic rays influenced human evolution is not new. And indeed, it was proposed very seriously by the great astronomer and science space writer Carl Sagan as early as 1973 in his book The Cosmic Connection. And it was an idea that he followed through in another important book that he wrote in 1977 called The Dragons of Eden, where he expounded upon this idea. And what he saw was that a distant neutron star, that's what he specifically said, a neutron star, which, by the way, is a collapsed main sequence star like our own sun, that's gone through the process of supernova and has collapsed to a very tiny object, probably the size of a normal city, and is made entirely of neutrons, probably an outer shell of crystal neutrons, which covers like a sort of liquid center of pure neutrons. It's a very unusual object, which astrophysicists, even today, are not entirely sure what it represents.
Yeah.
But just like a black hole, it will send out these incredible particle beams of energy that will be like some cosmic gun barrel, you know, shooting out bullets of cosmic stellar matter, debris.
Yeah.
And amongst these will be cosmic rays that will be reach velocities in the range of the speed of light. And although they may take, you know, many, many light years to reach us, because they're travelling very close to the speed of light, for them the distance would be you know, a matter of minutes to reach here.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this is a very, you know, weird dichotomy to understand what we mean, but, you know, this is all based on the special theory of relativity, you know, as set down by Albert Einstein himself. So, you know, this is within the realms of science. But let's not go there. I think that what's important is to say that this idea that cosmic rays influencing human evolution is something which is gaining ground, gaining momentum as we speak. I mean, when I came up with this idea for the Cygnus mystery, which, you know, I was working in isolation, really. It was just a wild idea that suddenly came to me. As I was writing the book, indeed, when I was coming to the conclusions, I suddenly found that some ex-NASA linked scientists who had also worked for the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Pasadena in California, and responsible for the launch of various space satellites in the 80s and 90s, that they had also come up with a very similar theory about the origins of, you know, human evolution being affected by cosmic rays. And this was the Meinl Institute out of Las Vegas, and, you know, they actually came over to Britain in December, and at a very, very prestigious archaeological conference in the north of England, in a place called Sheffield, they announced that, you know, that they felt that the cosmic rays had influenced evolution and gave their evidence for this. And the audience were obviously quite stunned and very bemused, because it was full of professors and archaeological students. And although they probably didn't get the response that they'd anticipated, this set a ball rolling, really, which is gaining momentum as we speak.
Yeah.
Plus, I also find out that during the mid-1990s, a British anthropological writer by the name of Dennis Montgomery, all his details can be found on my website, proposed in a book which is available for download free online, that cosmic rays from the Cygnus direction were involved in advances in human evolution during the Paleolithic Age. You know, I mean, I couldn't believe that there's this guy, you know, saying that they were coming from the same direction. Now, initially, he believed it may be from a supernova, which are known to produce, you know, very high amounts of cosmic rays and gamma ray bursts and whatever. but only on a very, very short period of time, maybe just several days, you know, before gradually dying off. However, now he has heard my evidence for Cygnus X-3 being the source of these cosmic rays. He has completely altered all of his writings and books to include this new information. So, you know, what I'm coming up with is something which makes sense to people, and I've written an academic paper about this, which is also available on the website, which people can download, you know, if they are scientifically minded.
Okay, excellent. Do you think that there are times when the bursts, the energy that is coming out from this area and from Cygnus, that it can be stronger at times and then, you know, die down for a while and just, you know, is that something that you have discovered?
What's so interesting about that statement is that Cygnus X-3 is very erratic. During the 1980s, it was giving out huge bursts. The highest known energies for cosmic rays were being reported coming from that direction. But then it went quiet, relatively quiet, and periodically it would send out bursts of cosmic rays and other types of electromagnetic radiation waves. But the scientists have actually said that they're now waiting for what they're describing as the next big bang to come from Cygnus X-3. And when this happens, you know, who knows what might take place.
Interesting.
But what's so interesting also here is that we're coming towards 2012.
Yep.
2012 is a time which is very much associated with astronomical events, because at dawn on the 21st of December, which is the mid-winter solstice, the Earth will align through the Sun with the center of our own universe. Now, this is something which is very well known and has been promoted by New Age authors who see this as the reason why that the ancient Maya had the end of their long count calendar on this day. But what's so interesting is, and I do not see this mentioned anywhere, is that the very position where the Sun will be birthed from, you know, it will gain its new birth at that time, is along a tube that is along the Milky Way, which is seen and accepted as a very important part of Maya cosmology. And this tube is the Great Rift. This tube starts at Cygnus. And universally, this tube is seen as like a birth tube. In ancient Egypt, it was associated with the goddess Nuit, the sky goddess. This same sky goddess and her association with the Milky Way is found in India, is the goddess Sarasvati. In Britain, it is the goddess Bride or Bridget. And she has other names in other parts of the world. So this is, so the stars of Cygnus fall at the exact position of the place of the birth tube. So it could be seen that the new Sun is actually born from the position of Cygnus, the very position where Cygnus X-3 is sending out its cosmic rays. Now, what do we also associate with 2012? But the whole idea of the indigo children. I don't know if you're aware of this concept.
I've heard about it, And Andrew, I mean, I want to finish off this segment right here
Okay,
now.
Fine.
Why don't you briefly just mention how people can get the book and when it's going to be out and so forth?
Okay. Now, it's released in Great Britain in mid-October. But if you want more information, I suggest you come straight on to my website at www.andrewcollins.com, and that just click on the sidebar, the Cygnus Mystery. That takes you through to page after page, breakdown of the entire book and the entire theory that I've talked about with you here tonight.
Who are we?
You have been listening to Red Eyes Radio. Part 2 of this interview will be available soon in our subscriber section at our new address, redeyescreations.com. That's redeyescreations, one word, .com. See you there.